Hi, everyone. It's Doug Fabrizio. Dolly Parton died this week. And all of the reflections have talked about her humble origins and her native gift for storytelling. But if you're looking for even more about her life and the songs she created along the way, you should go find the radio producer Jat Abumrad's podcast that he produced a few years ago. It's a 9-part series that he built on a dozen interviews with Dolly herself. And what Jat found was that in a country that was divided then, that's still divided, Dolly Parton was one of the only things that almost everyone agreed on. Her songs about mistreated women and her anthems for working people, just her persona, seemed to cut across these class lines in a way that almost nothing does these days. Jat also really breaks down why she was so remarkable, how she formed stories and moments into music. So we're going to rebroadcast our conversation with Jat Abumrad on Radio West. His podcast is called Dolly Parton's America. Jat Abumrad, host and creator of the program Radio Lab, spent a good part of his childhood in Nashville. And Nashville, he says in his new podcast, is Dolly Parton's world. He explains how Dolly was everywhere, on billboards, on the radio. They sometimes played her songs at the football games. But Jat wasn't really paying attention to Dolly Parton then. It was her world, but he says in the podcast he was just swimming through it. Part of it, he told us, had to do with his complicated feelings about the South, you know, as an Arab kid growing up among Southern Baptists. I asked him about it.
Growing up there, as you alluded to, as like this kind of scrawny, shy Arab kid who kind of hit high school just as Gulf War number one was happening. Yeah. And before that, I came from the country that basically invented suicide bombing. And so like I was just an oddity to the people that I went to school with. And so I felt on the outside of a lot of Tennessee pride stuff.
Yeah.
And Tennessee, every place has its sort of prideful stuff, but Tennessee pride is very loud. And so I felt on the outside of a lot of that stuff. And I can't say I necessarily associated Dolly with that, because she seems somehow much, much larger than any of that. But she is embraced in a certain way that made me uncomfortable sometimes. Not on her. It's just how her music was used. So part of this was for me like, oh, let me actually go back and investigate that place. Because, Doug, it's interesting what happens when you leave. When I left Nashville and I moved to New York, like, do you know how when you're a kid and one day in your life takes up such a massive space in your memory and you think that one day lasted a year in my mind?
Right.
The opposite happened for me when I left Tennessee. 13 years that I'd spent there somehow got collapsed so that it felt only like a day.
Huh.
And I was always really puzzled by that, and not in a good way. I thought, it's weird that I don't remember, that I have a story that I tell about my upbringing there that's sort of a very simple story. And so I kind of wanted to go back and actually like see it as it actually happened. And what was interesting to me about this project is that when you talk to Dolly and you talk to the people who love Dolly and you talk to the communities of people who embrace Dolly, you do discover along the way that the South is an incredibly complex place, right? And so Dolly is like a portal to all of that. And so my complex feelings about Tennessee, which got very simple over the years, are now way more complex again.
The thing that really got Jat started with the podcast was 2016, the election. That's when it really hit him.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
This was the moment the election was in like full blast.
The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic.
Crooked Hillary Clinton. Oh, she's crooked, folks. She's crooked as a $3 bill.
And unfortunately, there are people like that.
Lock her up is right.
There was the whole deplorables thing, and there was the lock them up kind of thing, and it was all happening, and the political landscape in America seemed like such a hot mess.
Ladies and gentlemen!
That's one side of the split screen. On the other side,
Dolly Parton.
I kept bumping into people who would describe going to a Dolly concert.
But she's an eagle when she flies.
You would see people who should, in quotes, hate each other,
yeah,
hanging out next to each other, all singing the same song.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living in it.
Evangelical church ladies standing next to men in drag, standing next to guys in trucker hats. And they're just digging the same songs, and it's polite, and it's kind.
We might run for president!
It's a space that seems so at odds with the other space, which was like what you were seeing in the debates and what we were seeing in politics. That was the initial juxtaposition that made me think, whoa, that's weird. Like, I want to actually live in that America. Honestly, I just thought maybe I would do an interview with her, and then maybe I would do like a portrait of the audience or something.
Huh.
I don't know. I had some of these vague ideas. And then sort of the other piece of this, which I have to say, is that I had an in. Dolly got into a car accident in 2013, and one of the people who happened to just give her some medical advice for a minute was my dad. And they hit it off. And so after he stopped being her doctor, they still hung out and became friends. And
I gotta ask you about this. So like friends, or just sort of occasional?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, friends. I mean, they talk. It trips me out. It still trips me out.
Yeah, me too.
It's so weird. It's so weird because he's not like a, he's just a guy. You know what I mean? He's not like a person who hangs out with famous people. He's just a doctor who... He's an awesome guy. I love my dad. And my dad should have lots of famous friends.
Sure.
But he doesn't. He's not that kind of guy. As I was having these thoughts about 2016 and all that stuff I talked about, meanwhile, they were becoming friends. And so I was able to then sort of at a certain point be like, Dad, you got to introduce me.
Right.
I want to do an interview. So he did, and I think she did the first interview as a favor to him.
Better take off the jewels before I hammer and mess up a good take.
I had heard you play 20-something instruments, is that right?
Oh, I play Adam.
I didn't fully appreciate what it would be like to talk to her, because she is, like, she's a historical figure. If she talks about the beginnings, she's talking about 1964. That's a ton of American history that she's intersected. And it's all in her music, right? She's written these songs which are somehow capturing historical moments all along the way. And not all of them cheery and happy. Like, what I thought was going to be a 20-minute interview just suddenly became like a 2-hour interview. And then it raised so many more questions.
Just because I'm blonde, don't think I'm dumb, 'cause this dumb blonde ain't nobody's fool.
Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Jad Abumrad is joining us to talk about his new podcast. It's called Dolly Parton's America. There will be 9 episodes altogether. They just dropped episode 3 this week. Jad joined us from the studios of WNYC in New York. When you were talking to her, for example, did you think, there's a show here? And there's a number of shows here.
Well, at first it was, I think there's an episode here.
Yeah.
And then I talked to her... 2 things happened. So I talked to her the first time, and it was this amazing conversation, but she kind of railroaded me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. She just, like, I was not prepared for the absolute 5-alarm fire of charisma that is Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Like, she just started.
And this isn't her
stories.
First rodeo either, right? I mean, she's done this before. Yeah.
Oh my God. So I was just sat there speechless as she told me story after story after story after story. And I didn't get a lot of good questions in, to be totally honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it raised a lot of ideas. Like, I was like, oh, wow, I really should look at the history of Appalachia. Like, these songs are so interesting. What was happening in the world when she wrote these songs? And, oh, wow, you had an aunt who was put in a mental institution by her husband? What's going on there? And oh, wait, your mom used to sing you murder ballads? What on earth? Why on earth would she do that?
Yeah.
Like, I had all of these questions that kind of tumbled out of that first interview. And then what happened was two things. I went and visited a class at UT taught by a professor named Lynn Sacco called Dolly Parton's America. We borrowed the title from that class, so as sort of an homage to them, because it was really moving what happened. Like, we sat – and I couldn't really – I can't really sum it up, but we sat in a room full of 10 or 12 college seniors who were about to graduate, and they'd all just completed a class where they were basically studying the history of their region through Dolly Parton.
Wow.
And the way that they told – like the personal experiences that they brought into the room about what it's like to be a kid growing up in the South, and how Dolly Parton makes them proud and but also for some of them makes them feel like kind of like a joke, right? Mm. And they had all of these really complicated feelings about their region, about her, about what they're going to be. Every single one of them told me stories of – how they would stand in front of the mirror and try and lose their accent. And it was really crazy. And I remember that conversation was the first time where I felt like, oh, this isn't just a story about an entertainer. It isn't a story about history. This is a story about people alive. And it's a story that's as much now as it is then. And that was the first time where I just kind of had that sense of like, oh, there's more. There's much, much more here. So then I took that interview and I went back and talked to Dolly a second time. And for that interview, we did weeks and weeks of research. I looked at every single public appearance she had done. I read her autobiography. I read every paper that had been written about her. I listened to all her music top to bottom, which takes a freaking month practically.
Yeah.
Because she's written so much. And I really sort of we really did the homework. And we went back and we asked her a bunch of questions. And I think she could tell at that point that we were super serious.
Right.
And she just sat there and talked with us for about 4 hours that time. And the combination of that interview plus the UT experience, suddenly at the end of both of those, I was like, oh, this is actually many episodes. It's not just one thing. And it's still at that point, I thought it was four, maybe four or five. But the thing that just keeps happening when you think about Dolly and talk with Dolly is that you just keep falling in these rabbit holes. And then suddenly it was six episodes. I think when I pitched it to WNYC, it was four, and then it became six. And then it just expanded into nine. And even just a few days ago, I was like, I think I want to make a 10th one. But I think I would die if I tried to make a 10th one. So maybe not. But, you know, it just keeps expanding because she's that all-encompassing as a personality and as a entertainer and musician.
It seems to me that that this podcast is going to challenge a lot of our conventional ideas about the South, about the kind of political climate, or certainly the climate of class. Like, people who live in a certain place and we have these preconceived ideas about certain people. I think that's one of the things that has come to me in just listening to the first few episodes of the podcast is it's making me rethink all of that. And I'm guessing you probably like that idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really gratified to hear you say that because that's what happened to me in the reporting.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about the stories that we tell about the musical genres that define a place or a culture, so much of it is bound in class and race. And what was initially fascinating to me was that Dolly seems to sort of tap dance over those labels or around those labels in interesting ways.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to be defined by those labels the way that other people sometimes are. And watching her do that led me to ask a lot of questions that had to do with, well, who is country music for? I mean, what is the, you know, I mean, who gets to tell the story of what the South is or is not? I mean, that was one of the really interesting wormholes we dove into, is that you look at like the, quote, hillbilly myth, which is such a fought over stereotype in Appalachia and in Nashville. it was largely imposed by New Yorkers. You know, like it was a convenient story that New Yorkers used to go down there and raid the coal mines and basically like set up gigantic industries. And it's a lot easier to take people's land if you call them hillbillies versus if you call them something else that's more complicated. So it's like seeing the ways in which these stories have gotten told and then untelling those stories has been super interesting to me. And it's made me it's drawn me back into my memory as a kid in Nashville, and it's made me really appreciate that place a lot more.
One thing I noticed in the interviews was I'm feeling for you in some ways as someone who does interviews. The part, as you said, in that initial, like, just let me just tell you some really charming stories and get you on your way. But then I noticed that on one hand, she is incredibly honest and forthcoming. Like, that's part of the persona. But then on the other hand, she's not completely forthcoming. She's really careful. She doesn't seem willing to want to gossip. She doesn't seem willing to want to go too deep on some personal stuff. Won't talk trash. Only seems willing to give you so much. And she'd brush you back a few times. You know, mm-hmm. like that's personal. Mm-hmm. I can't say. I'm not going to say the names. I don't know their story. You're not talking to them. You're talking to me. So what was that like? Because that to me seems to explain also one of the reasons why she's so thought so positively by so many people. She doesn't have very many negatives, and this is because for some reason she's able to, I don't know, seem forthcoming and yet not go too far. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, that was there were definitely moments where she sort of set the boundaries.
Yeah,
and she was like, I'll tell you this, but I'm not going to go there. And that happened a few times in the interviews. I mean, one of the things I set out for myself with is that you listen to every interview that's been done with Dolly Parton, and it always kind of hews to a certain kind of celebrity mm-hmm. thing, which is like, mm-hmm. how do you look so good? How do you look so good? And like, I hear you've celebrated your 40th anniversary with your husband. What did you guys do? Like, there's a lot of that kind of those kind of questions. And I was like, I intentionally set boundaries for myself. I don't want to go there. But when I did, when certain things come up, like you look at her early stuff, there's like tons of songs about suicide.
Yep.
You know, and you're like, wow, where did this come from? It's just a natural question if you listen to her music. Have you ever had a thing with that? And she said yes.
I was having a lot of female problems. I'd been going through a whole lot of family things, just the stress with a heartache. You know, there was just several things going on at that time, and I was just broken down.
You know, naturally you're curious. You're like, well, what happened? What drove you to that space? And she's like, no, I can't talk about it.
You said heartache. I mean, what was the heartache?
Well, it was personal.
Fair enough.
So there are moments where like her songs and her music and her creative output invite questions that she doesn't want to go all the way with. And I respect that on some level. You know, her music should be enough. It is enough. But she's such an interesting figure that you're dying to know more. The place where I actually found it very complicated is when you're dealing with when you're asking her about politics and her fan base. Her fan base is famously diverse. She has as many red state fans as blue state fans. And there have been times where she sort of had to tiptoe through some really difficult political situations. And we go into that deep in the series. And so I don't want to reveal too much, but the ways in which she refuses to say something when some of us might say, you've got to speak up.
Yeah.
I found it both inspiring and sometimes a little frustrating. I think somebody who chooses not to say something when it's clear that her saying something would make a difference, I think that can be frustrating. At the same time, I also feel like there are too many people talking right now, and I find it very refreshing that somebody with such power decides not to speak. I know there's something about that feels both inspiring and a little bit maddening. And she has opinions. You know she does.
Well, for sure. But is it part of it because she's just a really good businesswoman? Like, this is going to be stupid. I can't come out and say what I think actually about Donald Trump or anything else. I have Dollyland tickets to sell or whatever it is, or I, you know, she just, and it's not in a crass way, but in a really clever, smart way.
Yes, it's yes and. Yes, so part the part that's maddening is exactly what you said, which is that, like, it's driven by sort of commercial interests. But that's not all that's going on, is that there were times in our conversations where I felt like her unwillingness to judge was actually almost driven by faith more than it was business. That there's almost like a deeply Christian ethos there, which is that I am going to embody a different way of moving right now. And I'm just going to be somebody who doesn't judge, and it's not my place, and I'm not going to do it. And there's something in that articulation that felt inspiring. But the two live right next to each other, right? The sort of the commercial impulse to not speak, yeah, and the sort of more Christian impulse to not speak. They're not like they're really close by, and that was so interesting to me.
I found that in some ways that's the way I felt about the section where you're talking to her about feminism and whether or not she thinks of herself as a feminist, and she was pretty adamant about it, at least at first, like, no, I am not a feminist.
Yeah, that caught me off guard when I asked her a question which I thought was sort of a softball.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself as a feminist?
No, I do not.
She shot that right down.
I think of myself as a woman in business. I love men. And I really, because I have a dad, I have all those brothers, all my uncles I love, my grandpas I love, and I relate to them. And I write a lot of songs about women because I am a woman. Or I just write songs that women experience. But I write a lot of songs for men.
She really sort of had a negative reaction to that word, which was interesting. I mean, when you said earlier that, like, part of what the series does, I hope, is it looks at the sort of class assumptions that live inside of words, labels like that. Mm-hmm. It just became readily apparent to me in that moment that there's this, I mean, to state the obvious, a massive class divide in America, and that certain words kind of get lost in the gap.
Yeah.
And I think feminism is one of those words. And I think, I mean, it did occur to me, you know, with that episode, we end up going and talking to a woman in Kansas who very much mirrors Dolly's life in many ways.
I'm a little nervous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's totally great. Good. This is great.
Grandma Betty.
Grandma Betty. And yeah. I would very much identify as a feminist. I mean, who the hell cares what I think when it comes to who is and isn't a feminist? But she checks all the boxes. Like, she was a serious badass.
I picked up a cast iron skillet that had grease in it, and I whammed him upside the head and knocked him down. But he got up, and he staggered to the front porch, and then he fell off the porch, and that's how it happened, because he called my mother a pig, and I told him not to do that.
But also recoiled at the label, and... It did occur to me that if Dolly were to embrace the label, she might lose someone like Grandma Betty, which feels like a deeper loss to me than the gain she would get by wrapping her arms around the label. If that makes any sense?
Yeah. Well, you say in the episode that it occurred to you the lenses we have to see each other, the words we use to describe ourselves, that just isn't enough. There's something else. There's another kind of parallel universe layer there that we're not really taking into account.
Yeah. And that the lives we lead, as separate as they can sometimes seem, are very similar. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Grandma Betty, the journey she went on, I think, wow, that I don't know. Like, the fights that she fought don't seem that different than the fights that feminists fight every day, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But there's just the ways in which their language that gets applied to both experiences somehow divides them. It's almost that, like, that, just to get highfalutin for a second, like that idea of language games that Wittgenstein had,
mm-hmm,
that each universe is its own language game and its own unique sphere, and the language actually divides one universe from another. I really felt that when I was interviewing Grandma Betty. I was like, oh man, like the call the college courses, that world, that language game, somehow it's annoying that it feels separate from her world, you know? It shouldn't.
Yeah. It's interesting that she you describe those first albums of hers. You describe them as an ocean of pain. She talks about liking sad, pitiful ballads. And I'm wondering what you make of that, the darkness, also the sensitivity and the subjects that she covers, like extraordinary stuff like suicide and divorce and abortion and pregnancies that come outside of marriage, like all stuff like in the 60s. These were pretty taboo things.
My feet are moving slowly closer to the edge. Here is where it started, and here is where I'll end it.
Yeah, it was really illuminating to me when we found what I believe is the earliest recorded interview with her, which was done in 1967. But when I listened to that, she was 21 at the time, and she hadn't yet become the female singer on the Porter Wagoner Show, and she hadn't become the big star yet. But she was describing to this interviewer, like, just looking around at what was happening to the women around her, stories that she was hearing.
I like ballads, real strong, pitiful, sad, crying ballads.
I write a lot of sad songs, and I just write about things that maybe I've seen happen or things that have been in the family, and... Well, I have a new album out I didn't mention, too.
And she would just write stories about that. And that's interesting. Like, what that tells you is that a lot of those songs aren't just acts of imagination. They're acts of witness, right? She's seeing people going through these experiences, and she's writing songs about them. And, I think that, you know, and it connected in my mind. This is going to sound weird, but it connected in my mind to – like 1967, if you think about what was happening then, you had, like, again, class divides, language divides. You had in the coasts, you had these early second wave feminist gatherings called consciousness raising sessions, I believe is what they were called, where women would get together in a room and they would just share what was happening. It wasn't very judgmental. It was just like, this is what happened to me. And then somebody else across the table would say, well, that happened to me too. And they would start to sort of recognize the patterns of the system that was that they needed to rail against. And so there's something in that that feels very spiritually aligned with what Dolly was doing in her music, except she was doing it on the radio into a very different part of the country, at least initially.
Yeah.
And it was just an act of witnessing, an act of recognition. Like, this is what's happening. And then after that, you then decide, okay, now I'm going to change what's happening. And you see that in her lyrics as well. But first you have to recognize it. So I think that those sad-ass songs, as she calls them, were an act of recognition.
Well, Robert Orman, the music journalist you include in the podcast, he explains to you that Dolly has this knack for imagining the lives of other people whose lives weren't being seen. So it wasn't just women. It was working class men as well. And it seemed to me like that and this was maybe the religious part, that's about empathy. Right?
Yeah. I think it's about – I mean, you can tell too, like when she walks into the room, like she as guarded and as calculated as she can be, she's also – she feels it all, right?
I have to say that's really reassuring to hear, by the way. And I did wonder what it was like, how she was like, because she has to deal with people all the time. So just how genuine can she really be as, you know, being Dolly Parton? So it's good to hear that she was really genuine when she talked.
Yeah. And, you know, there was one moment, and I didn't include this in any of the episodes. I sort of wish I could have found a place for it. But I also didn't go deep enough to feel like it was worth it. But I do. We ran into her at Dollywood one day, and she had been promoting this new part of the park. And we talked to her in our bus, and she was so tired. And she said at one point, point blank, like, oh, sometimes it's too much to tell these stories over and over about your life. And it's just like too much for one person. And it was the first time that I got a glimmer that, like, oh, this is a person that contains a lot of different people, and we only ever get to see some of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In that way that a person could get trapped by their own story. But I was never able to get past that, so it didn't feel like something I could really include. But no, she seems extremely genuine at the same time guarded, and it's really hard to figure out where the boundaries of that are.
Yeah.
But very empathetic. Clearly, like, you can see that she will experience something and she'll turn it into a song, like, in 5 minutes. Like, her empathy finds its extension in her songwriting.
But, Jed, explain how good she was at that, because that's one of the really important points. I mean, there are a lot of people who can write songs that have empathetic ideas, but Dolly is really – she's really good at this. And she goes through this moment that you talk about in those early episodes where she – it's like she's on fire with creativity.
Yeah. This is – I mean, as a musician, this is what stopped me in my tracks. You know, one of the things that emerged for us as we were reporting out her Porter Wagoner years. So Porter Wagoner was this sort of a country music king of syndicated television. He was one of the really big sort of legends in early country music. And one of the guys who really took country music from its Nashville roots and sent it to become this Nashville – it's this national and then global phenomenon.
Yeah.
Well, she kind of got her start on the Porter Wagoner show, and we did a whole bunch of like retellings and reporting on those years. What you see in Dolly from like 1969, 70, 71, in that era, and then really leading up to Jolene in 73, is you see somebody that's just to say she was prolific is like the understatement of the universe. I mean, she was writing songs like many songs a day. They were just spilling out of her. And there was one moment where I was talking to her in one of her houses in Nashville, and she sort of gestured at the fireplace. I don't think this was the fireplace she was referring to, but she sort of gestured at it. She was like, you know, I'd sit by the fireplace, and I think I wrote Jolene and I Will Always Love You in the same night. And I had just been doing a bunch of research on both songs.
Yeah.
And I Will Always Love You is the greatest selling song by a female artist of all times. It hit number one 3 consecutive decades, almost hit it a fourth time 20 years after that. So it's one of the great love songs of the century, right? There's that. Okay. Then there's Jolene. And I had just been researching how many times that's been covered. It's been covered over 200 times in like 30-something different languages. Mm. And I just sat there thinking, you wrote both of those on the same freaking night? How on God's earth did that happen, that one person could have that much creative impact in an evening? I don't know. Like, that blew my mind. And, like, just – I think during those Porter Wagoner years, she was producing that much music, not just on that night but on almost every night. And it's really kind of extraordinary. And Robert Orman, who you mentioned, it told me that if she had been born a few hundred years earlier, she'd be Mozart.
Yeah.
We would think of her that way. And that's one of the things that's really interesting to me about the series, is that nobody thinks of her that way, but we should. You know, we think of her as the sort of that backwards Barbie persona, but we should think of her as the female Mozart.
You talk about in the podcast how her music has these shifts. They move. I mean, they begin as sad-ass songs, but then they start to transition, and they represent – you describe it this way in the podcast. They represent the progression of women in America. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, this is sort of an idea that came to us from Helen Morales, who might be like the first Dollyologist, as I think of it. Like, she was the first academic that I know of, at least, and I could be wrong, who wrote seriously about Dolly Parton.
You know, her lyrics go from – songs like
"The only way out,
the only way out is to walk over me."
Helen's idea, after analyzing the lyrics, was that, you know, you have the sad ass songs, which is like that period of recognition and witnessing, and is really dark and really sad and depressing. And then you have a second period, and you can hear this musically too. Like, she shifts from the sort of ballads to more percussive, energetic, up tempo. And during that time, you begin to see very different characters appear in her songs.
Then she moves on to songs that really are calling men out for cheating on women, for behaving badly.
You start to get portraits of women making decisions, women often leaving those men, fighting back, expressing anger. And then if you move forward even more, you begin to see a whole different category of music, which is where it's women singing songs for women.
Yeah.
Things like, you know, some of her most recent music, Changes.
Hello, I know,
I know you've got a world of problems, and you think, you can't do anything to solve them.
But I am here,
to tell you, you can.
Those can be the sort of more, I use this term not negatively, but more generic kind of empowerment songs.
Yeah.
They're not quite so vivid in their imagery, but what they are is much more universal. It's about somebody going through a tough time in any number of places and overcoming it. And so you see this
relentless hope, I think, is how you put
relentless
it.
Relentless hope, yeah. Right. And that's a – so she goes from – her musical biography starts in sad-ass songs and becomes a kind of fierce, relentless optimism. And those are the sort of the outer edges of her journey.
There's a great moment in the podcast where Helen Morales – tells you this story, reluctantly, I have to say. Here's this kind of restrained-seeming British woman who you've coaxed into telling this story of kind of personal story that she doesn't really want to say necessarily, even though she's included it in her book, and the impact of Dolly Parton's song, Light of a Clear Blue Morning. I really liked this moment because it was it was just kind of a beautiful moment, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, that one really caught us off guard, you know. And it was the moment also, I mean, I really debated a lot about whether to include it because it was not a moment that dealt with the politics or power between men and women. Mm. It was Helen dealing with a cheating scandal that involved her younger sister. And the way in which the community made it into like a, oh, look what those dirty Greeks are doing, because Helen Morales and her family are Greek. And this is what happens when you let the Greeks into our country. And so it became that story. And so it didn't somehow neatly fit into the argument that we were building in the first episode, but it was so moving.
Yeah.
There's something that felt so real and present about that story to me. You know, again, as the Arab kid in Nashville, I totally related to the way she described that.
It's not a calm summer. My mother develops agoraphobia. I put Light of a Clear Blue Morning on my stereo and wear out the cassette tape, playing it over and over. 'Cause I can't.
But there's something about the British accent part of it, too, that makes you realize the universality of these Dolly Parton songs.
Oh, my God. Totally. I was just actually this morning listening to – to talk about that universality in a different dimension. I was just listening to a Kenyan woman sing My Tennessee Mountain Home. And there's something about just simply hearing that just – it shifts your idea of who – of what this music is and what it could, how it could be used and by whom, you know?
Mm.
I kept running into that over and over again in this series.
You mentioned that when you're talking to Dolly, you fall into these rabbit holes. And there's a digression you take in episode one that I wanted to ask you about. Something that she said in an interview that you mentioned that you didn't quite catch at first. She's talking about the songs that she would hear on her porch about a Knoxville girl who got thrown into a river.
All those old mountain songs and all those old songs from the old world, all those old English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh ballads about the Knoxville girl.
Dead little girl in Knoxville, a town we all know.
Getting killed and thrown in the Knoxville River. And I was very, you know, impressionable.
And then you go and you explore the history behind it. Just say something about this part, because I loved this digression in the podcast.
We were talking about the sad-ass songs.
Yeah.
And then she said, I was like, so where did these come from? And then I think she said something like, well, you got to keep in mind, that's how I grew up. Like, I grew up with all those sad songs, you know, whether it's the Knoxville girl drowning in the river or something. And then she kept on talking. And then when I listened back to the tape, I was like, Knoxville girl in the river, what is that? So, you know, you do a quick Google and then you come up with Knoxville girl, and it's the most brutal, violent song I'd ever heard. I was like, wait, it's a song about a guy who goes on a walk with, I guess, his girlfriend, maybe his wife, I don't know. And then just at one point, he picks up a stick and starts beating her. And then it gets really, like, gruesome in his description of, like, she's all bloody. And then he grabs her by her hair and drags her and throws her in the river. And then she drowns. And it just goes on and on and on. And I heard the song and I was like, what the hell is this weird song, this twisted song? And it just so happens that there was a journalist named Paul Slade who had written a whole kind of cultural history of these murder ballads. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these songs, you know, shooting – mostly songs sung from the perspective of men killing women. And so called up Paul Slade, and he really traced a few of the songs, including the Knoxville girl, all the way back to their source. And they go back, in the case of that song, to 1685 in England, because a lot of these ballads were then, you know, the songwriters would get on boats and come over to the New World and bring the songs with them and then rename them based on where they landed. So, yeah, this was a ballad, it turns out, that was an account of a real murder. Paul sort of tracked it down, that it was a woman, a young servant girl who'd gotten involved with – I forget who the guy was, but she got pregnant. Yeah. He didn't want to keep the baby, and so he killed her, right, which is sort of like this, unfortunately, an age-old story. And he was caught and he was hung, and the murder ballad was written by a songwriter who was at the hanging probably as he was swinging. The guy wrote a song. And it was almost like a newspaper account of the hanging, sung from the guy's perspective. And then the songwriter would just kind of go from town to town to town, and it would sell these sheet music and sing the song. And it was kind of commerce. It was sort of pulpy commerce. And then that guy, whoever wrote it, ends up getting on a boat and coming to Knoxville, Tennessee. And then it becomes renamed Knoxville Girl. It was crazy to me that you have all of these songs sung from the perspective of the killer. And that Dolly, maybe what she was doing was flipping it so that you finally hear from the victims, at least in those early songs.
Episode two is you work through Dolly's complicated relationship with Porter Wagoner. And there's this thing that happens that – I don't want to give too much away, but there's this amazing end to the story where Dolly – forgives, and not only forgives, she helps Porter out. He's fallen on rough times, and I have to say, it's just a lovely story. And you tell Dolly in an interview, you said that you had this theory that the reason she had this broad appeal may be centered in that forgiveness that she offers to Porter Wagoner. Say something about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, the thing we kept encountering, and we, I mean myself and producer Shima Oliai, who made this with me, we kept encountering, especially in Tennessee and in Nashville, people would, when you talked about Dolly, people would say one of three things. They talk about the Imagination Library, which is her sort of literacy program. They would talk about Porter and what she did for Porter, and then they would talk about the Gatlinburg fires, where she basically set up this rescue and relief fund and like paid a certain amount of money to several hundred households, $1,000 a month, I think, for a certain amount of time. I mean, she really just did this incredible act of generosity when the physical infrastructure to help those people was not there. So she became like the state for a second. And helped all those people. So they would say one of those three things. And each one is maybe not so much the literacy one, but each one is centered around this act of kindness and forgiveness. And there is something – and she's often called Saint Dolly in the South. Yeah. And there was something about that that made – that was in my head as I asked that question. But I think it's much larger than just that region. It's the way that she behaves. She seems to – when we were talking earlier that she doesn't judge, she doesn't call out, and that can be frustrating. I think the flip side of that is what was in my mind when I asked that question, mm-hmm. which is that she doesn't – she stands for something that is so not adversarial. It's so not about fighting. It's about the opposite. And she doesn't really speak it. She just kind of lives it. And I think that's what I was thinking about when I mm-hmm. when I asked that question. You know, and one of the things that I think we can't lose sight of is that when she helped him out, I believe she was able to, you know, I mean, it's like I think she was able to repossess some of her songs that, you know, she had gifted to Porter at a certain part in their relationship. Like I think when she joined the show, she gifted him 50 or 49% of her publishing company. Wow. And so he suddenly had a huge stake in all this music that she'd written and some that he had as well. And so she was able to sort of repossess some of that as well. So there was some self-interest.
Sure.
But it not in a way that in any way cheapens what she did. Right. You know, I feel like it actually enhances it, if anything. Because one of the things I most respect about Dolly is that she shows those acts of kindness and forgiveness to herself as well, right? Like she forgives her own ambition. Like I can't tell you how many people I know who are so ambitious, but they feel bad about it. They feel like, oh, I shouldn't want the things that I want. And she's just super matter of fact. Like, no, I want to have my own show. I want to do this. I want to conquer the world. And that she's so at ease with it that it actually feels liberating. So she shows that own forgiveness toward her own self, and that it's all there in the Porter Wagoner story in all of its flavors.
When you go back to Nashville, do you think about the place differently now that you've done this podcast with about Dolly?
Oh yeah, my God, it's really made me think differently about that place. Yeah, I mean, Nashville is interesting. I used to think about Nashville as the South. I used to think of it as like the emblematic poster city of the South. And now what I realize is that it was very much a city built upon an industry of broadcasting that idea of the South out. You know, and yeah. So I grew up in a kind of caricature of the South because that was the business of Nashville. It's where all of the people who came from the country landed so that they could become stars singing about the country.
Yeah.
And so once I sort of realized that and I realized this is a city of people who are migrants. They're migrating from other places to come here. And that's what my family was doing and that's what all humans are doing all the time. And somehow that I was able to figure out how to place Nashville in a larger story. I also learned just on a more sort of concrete level that Nashville is just super complex. There's a lot of communities and a lot of different cultures and a lot of different – Tennessee is a very, very red state.
Yeah.
And but Nashville is a much more complicated picture than that. So I learned a lot about that. I learned about the politics. I don't know. I see Nashville a lot differently now. But oddly enough, I find myself drawn to East Tennessee. I find myself drawn. We spent a lot of time in Knoxville and in Pigeon Forge and in Sevierville and some of those areas, which are very, very different than Nashville, like a world away. Only 3 hours away, but like culturally, socially. And I find myself really drawn to that part of the world now.
Chad Emmerod, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was really great.
Chad Emmerod. His podcast is Dolly Parton's America, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram @Radio West. We're on YouTube @KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our social media producer. Our intern is Jill Tuft. Program produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.